Prior to outlining, however, the players and groups of players, I want just to say a couple of words about where our region, in my view at least, stands at the present time. What have been the key events of recent years which have changed and reshaped our Middle East to a considerable extent? And in this regard, let me begin by saying the following. There is a customary view of the Middle East, especially the Arabic-speaking part of the Middle East, which sees it as a place of more or less constant strife and change and war and conflict and revolution and counter-revolution and military coups and so on and so forth. And this is a somewhat simplistic picture, which I want to slightly complicate before moving on to the second part of my talk. I want to complicate it in the following way. It is a fact that if you look at the political history of the Arabic-speaking world or the most populated parts of it over the last half century, what you find, in fact, for most of the last half century is not endless instability and change and revolution and counter-revolution, but rather, by contrast, a rather strange picture emerges in which what is characteristic of much of the region is a curious combination in which regimes, powerful authoritarian regimes, fail at almost every one of the usual gauges by which we judge political success or failure, fail to develop economies, fail to develop civil societies, fail to develop political systems, and nevertheless, having failed at all these usual gauges of success, stick around, are not destroyed, remain in power, remain very good and successful at the one remaining test of a regime: can it stay in power or not? This characterized much of the Arabic-speaking world for much of the last half century, and this definition bisected the West and anti-West division. That is to say, we can find regimes of this type, or that fit this description, in the pro-Western side of the ledger. Obvious example would be Hosni Mubarak's Egypt. And we can, of course, find regimes in the anti-Western side of the line, which also fit this description. Assad's Syria, Ali Abdullah Saleh was on both sides, both pro-Western and anti-Western, Colonel Gaddafi's Libya, and so on and so forth. Now, this long period of what I refer to as failure plus longevity ended conclusively just over a decade ago with the series of revolutions, counter-revolutions, wars, elections, that, if everybody remembers, began in Tunisia in late 2010, spread rapidly to Egypt in early 2011, thence to Syria, to Libya, to Yemen, carrying away as it did so one regime after another, one formerly strong, centralized, dictatorial regime after another. Very interestingly and fascinatingly, as probably everybody here knows, none of the heads which rolled, so to speak, were crowned heads. The monarchies, for reasons which are a little bit beyond the scope of our discussion this evening, but the monarchies all remained intact, without exception. Not a single one of them fell. And the regimes that fell were the republics and the military regimes. Now, this period of great change and strife, I would suggest, has now finished. That is to say, if we were to look at the Arabic-speaking world today and try and find a country in which a process of change is being led by popular action from below, note that I say Arab countries, not Middle Eastern countries, then we wouldn't find one. We can find non-Arab countries such as Iran, in which there is such a process, not Arabic-speaking countries. So the wave has come, and the wave has largely, for now at least, passed. What does the landscape look like as we observe this landscape, once this wave of change has passed? What has changed and what has remained the same? First of all, what has not happened very clearly is that more representative forms of governance have not come to the Arabic-speaking world. Contrary to the great hopes of the first days of 2010 and 2011, of the Arab Spring, as it was called initially, this has not happened. We used to have to slightly caveat that remark by saying, with the partial and interesting exception of Tunisia, where two successful democratic elections have taken place, an Islamist party, Ennahda, has come to power. The Islamist party then lost the subsequent election and then left power. So here there was a reason for some guarded optimism. Unfortunately, or maybe fortunately from the point of view of neatness, from an analyst's point of view, we no longer have to say that. Because thanks to the activities of President Kais Saied in Tunisia, the short experiment in Tunisia with representative democracy has now largely come to a close. Therefore, representative democracy and governance did not come as a result of the ferment of the last decade. Nevertheless, something very profound has changed. Profoundly changed. And it is the following. Where once there was powerful, centralized regimes ruling across the space of the Arabic-speaking world, today there are large swathes of territory in which the state has either partially or even entirely fragmented and collapsed, where we don't find across the entire space an entity performing the full functions usually expected of a state. First and foremost, of course, as we learn from Max Weber, the function of exercising a monopoly over the means of violence. This such presence has collapsed and is absent. Absent from Libya, absent from Yemen, and maybe most interestingly from the point of view at least of where I sit in Jerusalem, absent from the entire swathe of territory between the Iraq-Iran border and the Mediterranean Sea, taking in three nominal Arab states, of course, Iraq, Syria, and Lebanon. And within these spaces, what we also find is commonalities. Within these spaces, what we are witnessing is a kind of war of succession or wars of succession being fought out for the most part by organizations capable of combining political and military activity and often organized on ethnic or sectarian or sometimes tribal basis. This overall definition applies to the areas I described, Libya, to Yemen, and most fatefully to that chunk in the heart of the Middle East, containing, of course, three great Arab cities, Beirut, Damascus, and Baghdad, which I mentioned a moment ago. Now, it is fascinating to note, from 2023's point of view, perspective, that all of the political and military organizations engaging in this war of succession, or wars of succession today, are supported by this or that powerful regional or global state. That is to say, Arab states may partially have fragmented and collapsed, but the competition in the region is still a competition of states expressed through the sponsorship or control of this or that organization. There was a moment, up till about 4 years ago, where organizations that were not supported by powerful regional states were nevertheless still powerful in these spaces. If we can think of some examples, well, the obvious example is the Islamic State organization, ISIS, right, which was not supported by any regional or global state, of course, but which nevertheless, at its height in 2014, controlled an area of territory roughly the size of the British Isles between Syria and Iraq. Another more maybe sympathetic example from an ethical point of view would be the Syrian rebel organizations of the early days of the Syrian insurgency, genuine grassroots insurgent organizations. But what the proof of the last half decade shows us is that all these organizations have been swept away. And what remains, the model that remains, is political military proxy groups controlled by or supported by powerful regional or global states. Who are we talking about? Some examples of this form of political organization. Hezbollah in Lebanon would be an obvious example, right? Of course, formed by and controlled by Islamic Republic of Iran. Another example, again, maybe a more morally happy one, at least from my point of view, I hope also from your point of view, would be the Syrian Democratic Forces, largely Kurdish military group controlling the area of Syria east of the Euphrates, supported, of course, by the United States. But in any case, this type of organization, dependent clearly on the will and support of powerful regional states. Which brings us then to the question, if the game is still one of states, which states are we talking about? Which states and groups of states are competing across this arena? And who has the advantage? And if one group has an advantage, why does it have such an advantage? In this regard, in my estimation at least, it is today possible to state with only a degree of simplification. There is a degree of simplification here on what I'm about to say, but it remains workable, I think. It's possible to say that there is today a contest between two fairly clearly defined groups of states, the competition between whom is the key strategic process taking place in our region. And these two groups of states, I will break the suspense by revealing them to you before going on to describe them, are the group of states and movements around the Islamic Republic of Iran on the one hand, and the group of states and movements arrayed against the Islamic Republic of Iran on the other side. There are other players, of course. There is a degree of simplification here, but these, I'm going to argue, are the two key players or groups of players that we need to think about a little bit. Allow me then now to think about each of them a little bit and to think out loud. Firstly, with regard to Islamic Republic of Iran and its friends, who are we talking about, first of all? Let us then list who we mean. Well, of course, Islamic Republic of Iran itself, the Hashd al-Sha'bi, or popular mobilization units, or what we call, often in English, is called the Shia militias of Iraq, who, in my view, I know others dispute it, but in my view at least, are today clearly the most powerful political and military actor within Iraq, and in my view, not only mine, are able, in fact, to act independently according to their own will without consultation with other forces in Iraq if they wish to do so. Another player, if we move west, of course, the Assad regime in Syria, now powerfully re-ensconced in Damascus and under no threat of destruction, even though it only still controls between 60 and 70% of the territory of Syria. Move a bit further west to Lebanon, the Lebanese Hezbollah movement, most earliest and most potent, I would say, of Iran's regional proxies, and today clearly the most powerful political and military actor in Lebanon. If we move down to the southeast, the Houthi or Ansar Allah movement in Yemen, which controls a large swathe of Yemen today, including the capital city, Sana'a, and back home, so to speak, at least for me, to the Israeli-Palestinian arena, where we can note two organizations which work together with Islamic Republic of Iran. One is Islamic Jihad, Palestinian Islamic Jihad, which is a fully owned franchise of the Islamic Revolutionary Guards Corps of Iran. And the second, Hamas, which is not a fully owned franchise of the Iranians. It is an independent, authentic, local Palestinian movement, but it depends on Iran for its military capacity. Hamas has other friends. It has also Turkey, also Qatar, but the one that gives it the capacity of missiles and rockets and armed action is Islamic Republic of Iran. Now, that's, of course, just that completes the list, and that, of course, is just a list. It doesn't explain to us why the Iranians have been so successful within this, as they have, within this space over the last 10 years. What, then, is the reason why Iran's proxies seem to be doing so very well, successful in Yemen, in Iraq, in Lebanon, in Syria, even among the Palestinians to a degree? The answer, in my opinion, is organizational. We need to look into the particular instruments, organizational instruments, available to Islamic Republic of Iran, which are not available to other regional states, to understand and answer this question, specifically in the shape of Islamic Revolutionary Guards Corps, which everyone here, I think, is familiar with the name, and with its external force, which has existed since 2008, the Quds Force. Iran has a group of people whose specific skill set is remarkably applicable and useful in the type of region which I've been describing for the last few minutes. What do I mean by this? Well, what is the Islamic Revolutionary Guards and its Quds Force? What does it consist of? It's not a military organization, though it can do military activity. It's not an intelligence organization, though it can do intelligence and counterintelligence work as well. But for the sake of the Middle East, what it is overwhelmingly, what it is convincingly, is it is a group of people whose specific skill set is the raising up of proxy political and military forces in neighboring countries that they might serve the interests of Islamic Republic of Iran. It's a strange job description, huh? I mean, Germany doesn't have a parallel organization to this. Israel does not. The United Kingdom or United States certainly do not. The reasons for its existence, of course, trace back, or this unusual organization's existence, trace back, of course, to the particular nature of the Iranian regime that regards itself as a revolutionary project and not only as a state authority. Be that as it may, it is also a fact that where states are strong and have powerful intelligence and counter-intelligence structures, the Islamic Revolutionary Guards Corps, for all their skill set, don't tend to get very far, right, where the state is strong. Examples we can think of in the Middle Eastern context, Bahrain, which after all is hardly a really powerful state, but it just is intact and exists, yeah, has a Shia majority. So it should be a place where Iran is able to organize, but there's no evidence of them organizing successfully. IIGC tries to organize, gets picked up, and gets sent home again if they are lucky. Eastern Saudi Arabia, right, also an area of large Shia population who are severely repressed by the monarchy of Saudi Arabia. Again, a natural place for the IIGC to organize. They try to organize, they don't get there very far, where states are strong. But here's the crucial point. In a region like the one I was describing 10 minutes ago, in which state authority has collapsed and fragmented across a large swathe of the space, and in which a war of succession or wars of succession are being fought out by political / military organizations, then the possession by a state of an organization whose specific skill set is the raising up of proxy political and military organizations will be worth its weight in gold to the state that possesses such an organization. And Iran possesses such an organization, and no other regional state does. And this, I will argue, or I would argue, is the explanation, or main explanation, for the success of the Iranian state and regime in these spaces over the last 10 years. Allow me to give you a slight anecdote. I'm not going to bore you with long war stories, don't worry about it, but a slight anecdote to try to illustrate this point in a more concrete or practical way. It comes from the Syrian context, a context in which I was very active as a journalist during the civil war there, between 2012 and 2019 or so, we would say. Probably you will remember that in the first years of the war, 2012, 2013, the Assad regime was in big trouble, and many smart and some even not so smart analysts were predicting its imminent demise, imminent collapse. Our defense minister, I mean Israel's defense minister at that time, Ehud Barak, for example, in December 2011, predicted that the Assad regime would fall within 3 weeks. Ehud Barak is now in retirement, of course, so I think now he's actually demonstrating on the street against the government of Israel, but Bashar Assad is still in the presidential palace in Damascus. There we are. People predicted this, but they weren't making stupid predictions because that's the way it looked. The regime was in terrible trouble. Why was it in terrible trouble? Because the Assads faced a structural problem that seemed to have no solution. The problem was that the Assad regime rested on a very narrow base of support. The Assads themselves, of course, are Alawis. People probably are familiar with who the Alawis are. It is a sect which split off from Shia Islam several centuries ago. The important point is not theological. The important point is that the Alawis are only around 12% of the population of Syria. So it was a very narrow basis of support for Assad. And the insurgency that was being raised against Assad was based on the Sunni Muslim Arab population, who are around 60% of the population. So it looked like Assad faced a problem which was insurmountable. Just not enough young people willing to fire a bullet and take a bullet in his name or in his behalf. Luckily for Bashar Assad, and through no achievement of his own, because he's not an especially clever man, but luckily for him, he had a very clever father, which was Hafez Assad, a much smarter man than his son. And it was Hafez Assad who had been smart enough in the 1980s to build a very close alliance between his regime and Islamic Republic of Iran. As a result of that, Bashar Assad, the son, was able in 2012, 2013, to go to Tehran and ask the Iranians for help. And say, listen, I have a problem, the problem I just described, can you help me? And luckily for him, because of existence of Islamic Revolutionary Guards Corps and its skill set, the Iranians were able to say, yes, we can help. Specifically, the late Major General Qasem Soleimani was able to say, yes, I can help. Why can I help? Because I have a way and a method of creating for you, Bashar Assad, a whole new armed force, a whole new army, parallel to the existing Syrian Arab army that you can't rely on. We're going to build a new armed force for you. And that's what they did. Quds force of the Revolutionary Guards Corps came to Syria and recruited a new army, recruited the young men from minority communities in Syria, not only Alawis, also Shia, also Christians, some Druze, even some Kurds, recruited them, armed them, trained them, and deployed them. And it was this force put into the gap of manpower of Bashar Assad that saved the day for the Assad regime, at least for the crucial 2-year period between 2013 and 2015, course, in 2015, you know how the story ends. In September 2015, the first Russian aircraft appeared over the skies of Syria, and this was the end of any chance the insurgency had for victory. But it was the Revolutionary Guards Corps, through their methods, methodology and praxis, we can say, which saved the day for the Assad regime. Now, this shows us the power of the abilities of the Revolutionary Guards Corps in a specific context. What it also shows us is that this stuff is not easy. They maybe make it look easy a little bit, but it's not easy. How do we know that it's not easy? Because as journalists working the Syrian beat at that time, we were also witness, parallel to what was going on the way I just described, to a similar effort being undertaken on behalf of the insurgency by its backers and supporters, by Saudi Arabia, by Qatar, by United Arab Emirates even a little bit, by Turkey, and by the United States also. They were trying hard to build up an effective proxy force among the rebels and to turn them into an effective force, the way that Qasem Soleimani was doing for the regime side. And they made a huge mess, is what they made, a disastrous mess. They tried to do it by the private sector method. The Gulf people are good with money. That's what they know about. So, you know, piles of money came down to southern Turkey, and representatives of local rebel militias would cross the border into Turkey and promote and advance themselves before representatives of Gulf states who would then give them money or not give them money. And you can imagine what this produced. Crisscrossing lines of financial support to rival rebel militias in northern Syria, who, with two results. One is that they rapidly became corrupt, and secondly, they began rapidly to fight with one another. So without wishing to go into too much detail, what the other side showed us is that what the IRGC does, it does well, and it's not that easy. It's easy to do it wrong, and they tend to do it right. Thus far, then, with regard to my recruiting pitch for the Revolutionary Guards Corps, they don't do everything well, of course. In fact, they don't do very much well. The Iranian regime does very little successfully. It can't do economic development. It can't produce political institutions. It can't advance the rights of its citizens. It can't do anything very well. In fact, when it takes over your country, as it has taken over Lebanon, the end result is what we are seeing in Lebanon today, namely the collapse of the country in question. So it can't do much very well. By the way, it can't do conventional warfare very well either. From an Israeli point of view, as we know, it can't do air defense very well. It can't do counterintelligence, even in its own capital city, very well. There are many long lists of things that it does very badly. But the one thing which it does well, it does extremely well, and for reasons I've hopefully illustrated, the one thing that it does well has been supremely applicable to the moment that the region has been passing through over the last decade. Thus far, with regard to the Iran-led regional bloc, I mentioned that there is a counter-bloc as well. So let me spend a couple of minutes looking at this counter-bloc before going on to look at the international implications of what is taking place. First of all, who do we include in this counter-bloc? The counter-bloc is a much more nebulous proposal, if I can put it that way, than the Iran-led regional bloc. The Iran-led regional alliance exists, whether you like it or not, whether we like it or not. The counter-bloc, some people would say it exists, some people would say it is an exaggeration to describe the situation in that way. Which countries would we be talking about in this putative counter-bloc? Well, Israel, of course, United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, Saudi Arabia, and Egypt. And then some more minor players, non-state players, maybe the Kurdish regional government in northern Iraq, maybe the Kurdish authority in northeast Syria, and so on and so forth. This would be the members. Now, there's an obvious difficulty with this list compared to the other list of the other side, which is, of course, that clearly this list is a list of countries that have nothing in common in terms of ideology. Right? There is no ideology, obviously, linking Saudi Arabia, Israel, and the PKK guys in northeast Syria. They're all very different prospect. Yeah? There's no ideological. There is also no form of governance that they have in common. We have, in the list I just gave, countries which system of governance goes all the way from theocracy, in the case of Saudi Arabia, across absolute monarchy in the case of the UAE, across to democracy flawed but on its feet in the case of Israel, to secular authoritarianism in the case of the Kurds of northeast Syria, and so on and so forth. So nothing in common in terms of ideology or in terms of form of governance. And nevertheless, as it turns out, the possession of common enemies can still be a very remarkable adhesive keeping countries together. And these countries all have two common enemies, actually, each of which is just as important as the other. One is the Iranians and their friends, who we've been describing, and the other is Sunni political Islam. Sunni Islamism in the form of Muslim Brotherhood, Al-Qaeda, and these type of groups are also the enemies of, for different reasons, of all the people, the groups of people that I just mentioned. The other thing which they all have in common, and it's important too, is that each of them, each in their very different way, are all, to one extent or another, aligned with the United States and with the West. Again, for different reasons, to different degrees, but nevertheless, they all are. And these factors, it seems, have been sufficient to produce something which more and more is beginning to resemble an alliance. What do I mean by more and more? Had I been giving this talk 2 years ago or 3 years ago, I would have said there isn't an alliance. People claim there is one, they're excessively optimistic, there's a bunch of countries with broadly similar interests, and that's where it ends. Today, however, I would suggest that there is something closer to an alliance. What has changed organizationally in the course of the last 2 years? A number of developments. Most importantly, the Abraham Accords, which you're all familiar with, of August 2020, which brings Israel and UAE, which are the most important components, and Bahrain as well, and Sudan as well, and Morocco as well, into formal diplomatic relations. The Israel-UAE component is the important one. This relationship has flourished beyond expectations, actually, over the last 2 years, in economic terms and in terms of strategic cooperation. So the Abraham Accords have taken on greater flesh over the subsequent years with the formation of additional structures. People are probably familiar or maybe familiar with the I2-U2 structure, which brings together India, United States, UAE, and Israel into a single diplomatic forum announced on July 2022. People may be familiar also with the Middle East Air Defense Alliance announced by then Defense Minister of Israel, Benny Gantz, in June of last year. Maybe you're familiar also with the Negev Summit, which, again, this is about more civil relations, is a regular meeting place for foreign ministers of the countries in question to discuss mainly civil issues, not military issues. These are all examples of a process in which this alliance, having been just an idea, then taking on some kind of organizational form, is now taking on thicker organizational form. We know also from reading our media carefully that behind the scenes a great deal more is going on, also in terms of arms purchases, also in terms of intelligence cooperation. I think it was Associated Press. If there are any Reuters people here, or AFP, then I apologize, I might be wrong. I think it was AFP, a few months ago, who broke the story that in the Dafra air base north of Abu Dhabi in the United Arab Emirates, you can find, if you go and look very carefully, an Israeli air defense system, the Barak 2 air defense system. That's to say the Emiratis are buying Israeli air defense systems to defend themselves against the Iranian drones and missiles which have attacked them on several occasions over the last 2 or 3 years. They're doing it quietly, but they are doing it. So there is more to this than simply formal cooperation structures. There's real stuff happening on the ground in terms of defense cooperation, and I would imagine confidently in terms of intelligence and counterintelligence cooperation also. Thus far, then, with regard to the counter-alliance, it's still not as tight and as close as the Iranian alliance, but it is taking on its own interesting form. And let me conclude in terms of looking at this group of countries by saying the following. It's a shame I don't have a map here, but you probably know the Middle East well, so you imagine the map in your head. I talked about the countries that Iran is active in, and they form a coherent picture in terms of the regime's strategic goals. The regime is trying to reach the Mediterranean and it is trying to reach the Gulf. It's trying to create parallel areas, contiguous rather, areas of control all the way westwards to Mediterranean and southwards to the Gulf. From an Israeli point of view, the bad news is that part of its strategic goals is also, of course, the destruction of Israel. And as part of this, it is trying to envelop Israel and its enemies to the west and to the south. This is a commonly known point, which I'm sure you've all heard before. But it is a fascinating thing to note that maybe you didn't hear before, that you can also, by looking at the map, discern a counter-envelopment strategy. That is to say that Israel and its allies are also trying to build a system of alliances that surrounds Iran. If you think about the southern part of that fork is, of course, the Abraham Accords, Israeli relations with UAE, with Bahrain, and hopefully in the future, from Israel's point of view, with Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. And there is a northern tier as well to this, which goes through northern Syria, northern Iraq, and up to Azerbaijan. Right? This is a second part of the fork whereby Israel is also trying to surround Iran. Not, of course, through IRGC methods, not through proxy warfare and militias, but through conventional diplomacy and conventional intelligence sharing and conventional military activity sometimes too in Syria and in Iran itself and in Iraq as we know about. So two forces in a fragmented, collapsed region, very different alliances, each of which working against one another. Lastly, before I be quiet and begin our discussion, the role of international actors in all this, which I think is changing, which was part of the title, of course, and I think is very significant in all this. First of all, the United States. We mentioned that all the members of the counter-alliance are broadly associated with the United States. All of them are also worried. And they're worried because they all perceive, correctly, I think, that the United States is trying to draw down its activity in the Middle East. The United States doesn't love them the way it used to, let us say, right? The Americans are not leaving the region. Incirlik Air Base is still there. Al Udeid Air Base is still there. The Fifth Fleet is still in the Gulf. The Sixth Fleet is still in the Mediterranean. These are not changing. But when it comes to major projects inland and upstream in the Middle East and South Central Asia of the kind that the Iraq invasion or the Afghanistan invasion were, America's not coming back to anything like that anytime soon. These were not successful, of course, and there's no energy for them. The Americans are facing a peer strategic challenge in the growth of Chinese power in East Asia. This is the most urgent problem. And, of course, they are now facing a conventional land invasion in Europe, the invasion of Ukraine, which is taking up a great deal of their time and energy. So there's not much bandwidth left for the Middle East. What the Americans are doing, though, is they are standing behind efforts of regional countries to work closer and closer together. Taking Israel under the framework of US Army CENTCOM, for example, and the very large-scale military exercises that have taken place on the basis of CENTCOM over recent weeks is all part of the way that America is trying to gently push Israel and the Arab allies closer together. And to say to them, we're not necessarily going to be here for you, unless we absolutely have to be, but you should start working together and finding ways to make this work. From an Israeli point of view, there's a very large silver lining to this cloud, in the sense that from the Arab Gulf countries' point of view, they want hard power, friends and capacities. They don't have it themselves. If America is not there, they look for who else can maybe help in those kind of activities, air defense, intelligence collection and so on, and they notice that in Jerusalem and Tel Aviv, there are a few people that are quite good at that stuff and know how to do it. So it's a good thing from Israel's point of view as well. Thus far, quickly with regard to America and with regard to the other major player who I want to consider for a couple of minutes, Russia, of course. Now, Russia found its way back to our region with a very successful intervention into the Syrian civil war, as we know. It was successful from two points of view. One, the obvious one, that the Russians achieved what they wanted to achieve. Right? They wanted to preserve the rule of Assad regime and preserve their own strategic assets on the Mediterranean coast in Syria, the naval bases in Tartus and Latakia, and the air base in Khmeimim in Latakia province, close to the sea, Mediterranean Sea in Syria. They wanted to achieve that, and they achieved it. But the other thing which they did, which is interesting part of their success, is they did that with a very light footprint. Yeah, they did it without commitment of conventional Russian forces on the ground and with only a relatively small number of aircraft. As it turns out, I think, we can now say from the vantage point of March 2023, part of the reason for that success was because the enemies were so very unimpressive, actually. This maybe made the Russian force look a little bit better than, as it turns out, they actually were. But in any case, in terms of their goal, they had a clear goal, and they achieved it. And this put them back in the region. And it put them back in the region in close cooperation with the Islamic Republic of Iran, of course, because the Syrian success was a two-way affair. Not Assad. He had very little to do with the success. He just asked for the help, and the help came. But the success was Russian, but also Iranian, with each side performing functions that the other one could not perform. Fascinatingly, what has changed in our region as a result of the Ukraine invasion is that the balance of power and the nature of the relationship between the Islamic Republic of Iran and Russia has changed. If prior to February 2022, the relationship was a contingent one, born more or less of a kind of accident, that they had a number of common interests and common allies, not as a result of planning or certainly not of ideology, but simply because, as it turned out, Assad happened to be friends with both of them. If that's what it looked like prior to February 2022, today it looks very different. Today there is a much deeper reality of growing strategic partnership, I would argue, between Iran, this Iranian regime, and the regime or government in Moscow. Because as it turns out, the Iranian contribution has been crucial to the Russian war effort in Ukraine, in the shape of the SU-36 Shahid. My air defense friends tell me not to call them drones. Apparently they are called loitering munitions in the terminology of people who deal with such things. In any case, you know what we're talking about. The Iranian drones, they're not here, so I'll say it anyway. The Iranian drones have been absolutely crucial to the Russian effort. The Russians did not invest in drones. As it turns out, this very powerful Russian army that used to have great parades through Red Square every May 9th was an analog army. It was not really a 21st century army so much. Drones, they didn't bother investing in. Tanks, they invested in. Drones, not so much. They needed drones, and it was the Iranians who stepped in and have helped them. Very hard to imagine. The Iranians, in a certain sense, have been the senior partner when it comes to helping the Russians in Ukraine. They've been supplying stuff that the Russians did not have. This has changed the nature of the relationship, and it may well change it the other direction as well. And we in Israel, or those in Israel who deal with such things, are watching this very carefully. Because if it turns out that the Russians, as a result of the nice favor that the Iranians have done them with regard to drones, want to return the favor, as any good friend should, I suppose, hopefully in this case not, but as any good friend generally you would think should, and if as a result of that they start to think about such things as providing the Iranians with S-400 air defense system or with Su-35 fighter aircraft, which is very possible, by the way. They've actually already committed to providing Su-35s. They haven't delivered them yet, but they've said they're going to. This puts the Iranian regime onto a vastly higher level of capacity in military terms. It means that any Israeli or American, for that matter, military planner thinking about acting militarily against the Iranian nuclear program would have to think very carefully. It may well be that Israeli F-35s are able to defeat the S-400 system. But we don't know that. And that's not the kind of thing that you want to test in real time, especially not with such a crucial mission as that would be. So this new relationship is changing the nature of the balance of forces, I would suggest, in our region. It has also changed, the Iranian-Russian relationship, I mean, because the international position of Russia has changed profoundly as a result of the Ukraine invasion. If prior to February 22, the Iranians could look at the Russians as a kind of passport to international normality, as a kind of corridor through which you could reach the West and have dialogue with the West. Putin's relations with the West were not great, of course, but much better than those of the Iranians. This is no longer the case. Today, the Russians and the Iranians are equally isolated, and they're equally absolutely on the other side from the West. That is to say, and on this I will conclude in a few moments, that is to say that arguably what we are looking at in the Middle East now is a situation in which our own long-standing situation of strategic confrontation between two blocs, which I described earlier, is now coming to be a component of a much larger global contest between the United States and its allies on the one side and an emergent alliance of Russia and Iran on the other. In this regard, please, sir. This is what I'm about to conclude with. What about PRC is, of course, the crucial question that the gentleman asks. So what do we know about that? Well, we know that Secretary of State Antony Blinken at the Munich Security Conference 2 weeks ago, was it 3 weeks ago, said that intelligence exists regarding Chinese plans to provide weaponry to Russia in the Ukrainian context. Blinken didn't tell us what the intelligence was, and nobody has been smart enough to find it out yet and publish it, so we don't know if the intelligence actually exists. Assuming that it does, or if it does, then we are into a whole new situation, of course. Because if the Chinese have made the decision, they themselves, by the way, have dismissed, of course, Blinken's statements. But if it turns out that they have made a decision to that Putin cannot be allowed to lose in the Ukrainian context, then we're into a vastly more serious emergent reality, of course, in which you have the outlines of a strategic alliance, in this case of Islamic Republic of Iran, Russia, and China, arrayed against the United States and its allies in Europe, in the Middle East, and presumably also beyond. If that is the case, then we are looking at a whole new world, and one, I suppose, in which we are all going to spend the rest of our lives living in, for better or for worse. On that happy note, then, I'll be happy to conclude. And I'm very looking forward to your questions and indeed comments. So please have a way with it. And thank you.